Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, the new mini-documentary, How to Run 100 Miles, a film about persistence, follows friends Jason and Brendan as they prepare for and take on a 100-mile trail run. I will talk with Jason, that's Jason Syme, about the obstacles he's faced and overcome in his life and as an ultra-marathon runner. But first, bullying is not a new problem, but it feels like bullies are constantly finding new ways to hurt others. Fortunately, there are also some new effective tools being developed to combat and prevent bullying. We're going to find out about some of the techniques being used in the Des Moines Public Schools, and we're going to start with an innovative approach being used in Dubuque. It's called the Green Dot Program, and it's based on the premise that nobody has to do everything, but everybody can do something. Mae Hinchin is the Learning Support and Equity Liaison with Dubuque Community Schools, and she is here with me now. Hello, Mae.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
And thank you for having me.
Explain to me a little bit. I know that there are lots of different parts, but give me an overview of how Green Dot works.
Sorry, I'm having a little trouble with our connection.
Okay. Mae, can you hear me now?
I can, yes.
Great. Can you explain a little bit about how Green Dot works?
Sure. So our Green Dot Violence Prevention Program is a program. So we know that when any type of high-risk situation happens, that based on numbers of students versus teachers, that students are more. I'm specifically talking about bullying. If a child ages and bullying behavior.
Okay, you know what, Mae? We are having a little bit of difficulty hearing you. The connection keeps cutting in and out. So why don't we hang up and try reconnecting so that we can get a nice clear signal and talk more about the Green Dot program in Dubuque. As I mentioned earlier, we're also going to talk about programs in the Des Moines Public Schools. And is our guest from Des Moines with us, Jake Troja?
Yeah, I'm here. This is
Jake. Nice
hey,
to talk to you. Jake Troja is the director of school climate transformation with the Des Moines Public Schools. And while we get Mae reconnected and make sure we have a clearer connection with her, Jake, I know that you have a lot of different programs that you've implemented throughout the Des Moines Public School system. Give me an idea of what the overall approach is.
That's a great question. So we look at bullying really as an outcome that happens within a student's social structure. So one of the things that we wanted to address district-wide is what are we teaching around student behavior across the district? What's our core instruction look like? So we have what we call kind of a multi-tiered behavior framework that outlines what our instruction looks like across tier one, all students receive across the district. So one of our major ways to combat bullying as an outcome is to ensure that we have quality core instruction around behavior. So students, so we don't assume that students know exactly what to do when they come to school and how to interact with their peers, that we actually teach and monitor those skills as students, you know, grow older within our programs.
All right. And you don't necessarily have the same approach in every school. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a good question because, you know, to answer that in the most succinct way possible is kids are different in every school. The community is different in every school. So we have some general guidelines, some practices that we know are high yield practices that we advise schools on using, but how that looks and plays out in every school should depend on the school environment, should depend on the staff and the community that's built at that school. So we allow the autonomy at the school site for them to decide how those programs specifically get played out.
And of course, every school, as you mentioned, has a different culture, a different environment, different leadership as well. I can imagine that some school leaders would be very good at dealing with bullying. Others, that may not be a strength. So how do you do quality control?
That's a great question. So as I mentioned before, we have a universal plan that we look at in terms of instruction for behavior. And within there, we have fidelity checks. So we have our highest yield strategies built into that plan. And we go around to schools several times a year. We look at data, student outcome data, and we check for fidelity of implementation of that plan. And then using that data, we kind of, you know, do a data decision process where we figure out what is it telling us, where do we need to improve, and then it helps us make those decisions at individual school sites.
All right, and we'll get into more specifics as well. I want to bring May Henschen back into the conversation now. As I mentioned earlier, Learning Support and Equity Liaison with Dubuque Community Schools. May, can you hear me better now?
I can hear you better, yes.
Wonderful,
thank you.
And I can hear you as well. So,
I just had a little cutting out again.
All right,
so
well,
hopefully
let's
play this last.
Right, let's give this a try. Can you describe for me, we'll start over, and give me kind of the overview of what the philosophy is behind Green Dot?
So our Green Dot Violence Prevention Program has the two basic components to it. One, violence will not be tolerated in our schools. Two, everybody has their part in playing a role in our schools. So with the Green Dot Violence Prevention Program, we implement that at the middle school and the high school levels. Currently, we were the first school district in the entire country to implement as big and as wide as we do all of our middle schools and high schools. We're working on implementing Green Dot in our elementary schools, hopefully beginning next year. But what we do with the Green Dot Violence Prevention Program is empower children to stand up to make a difference if they see a potentially high-risk situation happening. So when we talk at the middle school and the high school level, that potentially high-risk situation might be bullying, it might be dating of sexual assault. We talk a little bit more about sexual assault at high school level. So what we're doing is helping children to identify what a high-risk situation is. We call those red dots. And then we help children to understand what they can do if they see that red dot happening. So the motto of Green Dot is more green dots equal.
And we just missed out on the motto. Can you repeat the motto again?
I'm sorry?
With the motto cut out on us. Repeat the motto for us again.
Oh, I'm sorry. More green dots equal less red dots. And more children are safe at school.
All right. So putting the power in the hands of kids, some people may think that that sounds a little counterintuitive. A lot of kids really depend on adults to take care of any problems that they might see in their school with bullying or with violence. Why turn to children in this way?
That's a great question. We have certainly made sure that adults support the program. Our adults in our schools know about the program, but really, we empower the children because there are more of them, and because if there's a high risk situation happening, the children are more likely to recognize it. If somebody is engaging in bullying behavior, they might be doing that online, where a teacher's not supervising. They might be doing that, you know, behind a teacher's back, that sort of things. Students really know the pulse of their schools, and students really have the power to influence the culture of their schools. When we're talking about adolescents, at this point in their lives, children are so much more likely to depend on the opinions of their friends and the acceptance of their friends. And so that's why we have empowered children, because they can do something about it. In Green Dot, we talk about three types of green dots. At the middle school level, we have the acronym of D, O, and T for dot. D is you can do it yourself. You could directly get involved and you can say, hey, bullying is not right. You shouldn't do that. Or I like that person. Stop picking on him. O means others can help, and that's where the adults can come in. Children, if they don't feel like they can impact this situation, they can ask for help. They can talk to a teacher or a counselor. They can talk to the bus driver. They can talk to a police officer. They can talk to lots of other people and get them to help. They can talk to other children and get a group of them to maybe sit with somebody who's being bullied at lunch. And T stands for talk about something else. So they could create a distraction, talking about homework or the basketball game last night, creating a distraction so the person who's engaging in bullying behavior is essentially distracted from his or her behavior, which stops that red dot situation from happening.
And if there's a red dot situation and a child takes action and doesn't necessarily get adults involved, is there some sort of reporting process, or is that where it ends?
Well, that would depend on the situation, I think. A lot of times it ends. You know, the research shows us that in 73% of the cases where a bystander intervenes, the bullying situation ends. So if a student intervenes and there's, you know, that red dot situation in the hallway or in the cafeteria, and they intervene, maybe they get others to go sit with the target, and it stops, then it's over. If it is repeated, if the behavior continues, then we would definitely hope that students would report it so we could do, you know, just have kind of a multi-pronged approach. So the students are doing really good things too, but then maybe the adults need to get involved if it's repeated.
And you said it's a little bit different for high school. Is there a different acronym, different focus in high school?
Yes, actually, the high school, because just developmentally appropriate, at the middle school level, we talk about bullying. That's where we see a peak in bullying behavior, mm-hmm. is at that middle school level. By high school, our students have had a lot of information. They've had a lot of prevention messages about bullying. So we shift this, again, talking about power-based personal violence, the type of relationship where someone uses their personal power, whether that be strength, popularity, whatever that might be, to inflict a red dot on someone else. So at the high school level, we start talking a little bit more about dating violence with students and with sexual assault. I think we have to be honest with ourselves that the behaviors we know that sexual assault is at its highest risk at the college level. And with our high school students, as they're preparing to go off to college, if we can talk to them about consent and how power can be abused in intimate partner relationships, then we're preparing them for when they go off to college and they don't maybe have adults quite as close as when they're living at home. So, and more at the high school level, students are engaging in more dating behaviors. So we talk about what does a healthy relationship look like? What does an unhealthy relationship look like? We still talk about three types of green dot at the high school level. We call them direct, delegate, and distract. So it's the same thing, directly get involved, delegate, getting others to help, or distract, create that distraction.
And it sounds like when you say violence, you're not just talking about physical violence, but social and emotional violence as well.
Absolutely. We talk a lot about, like you said there, social violence. We talk a lot about cyberbullying. We talk a lot about online behaviors and making, so that's obviously, that's not physical, but it's maybe creating isolation and exclusion, hurting people's feelings via social media, texting, phone calls, you know, those types of things.
We're going to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about bullying prevention techniques used in the Dubuque Public Schools and in the Des Moines Public Schools. With me, Mae Henschen from Dubuque, and also with me, Jake Troja from Des Moines. We'll continue this conversation in a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about different techniques to combat and prevent bullying in the public schools. I'm talking with Jake Troja of the Des Moines Public Schools. He's the director of school climate transformation. And also Mae Henschen is here. She is the learning support and equity liaison with Dubuque Community Schools. And Mae has been describing a program that was implemented in Dubuque. Mae, it was implemented in the fall of 2013, right?
Correct.
All right. And this is called the Green Dot Program, which is designed to empower kids to also try to shape the environment at their schools and prevent bullying, prevent other kinds of violence in their schools. And Mae, I'm curious. So this has been since the fall of 2013. How has this changed the climate at Dubuque Schools?
I think it's changed the climate in several ways. One of the ways is the conversations that adults and students are having when we talk about everyone has the responsibility for the safety of our schools. So we talk about it's not just a bullying prevention group, it's not just the adults, but everybody has a role to play. Adults, students, visitors, parents, in supporting kids. The other thing that is notable for us is we've seen a decrease in the reports of bullying. We have about a 79% decrease in the last 4 years since we've been implementing in the Green Dot Violence Prevention Program. I think that there's still work for us to do. We have about 11,000 students in our school district, and even if one student is experiencing one of those red dot situations, we want to make sure that all students feel comfortable and all students feel empowered to do something about it.
Would it be possible for you to tell me of a specific example of where you've seen Green Dot implemented and it's really helped something?
We had a student leadership training. That's how we empower the students and help them to understand about our Green Dot program. We have a 6-hour student leadership training that we hold several times a year at each of our schools. And last year, we had a student leadership training for one of our middle schools. The very next day, when students were back at school, there was a new student at their school. And 2 different times during the day, students who had been involved in the Green Dot training noticed that this new student was being bullied. In one situation, it was at lunchtime, and one of the girls went over and sat with this new student who was also a girl and just made her feel welcomed at lunch. And then in another situation at a different part of the day, a young man who had been in the Green Dot training noticed that he didn't think the girl was being treated fairly, that she was, you know, new and kind of being targeted for being new, and he let a counselor know at the building. So both students reported afterwards that they had learned that at Green Dot, so they were doing their part to make sure this new student felt welcome.
And you talk about student leadership training. Is there training for all the students as well, or just a select group of students?
We start with about 15 to 20% of our student body. And really, with the Green Dot Violence Prevention Program, we are training student leaders to go out and live their lives in their environment, with their social groups, with their clubs, and to make that difference by maybe telling people that I think violence is wrong and we shouldn't bully, those types of things. 2 of our middle schools have taken a radically different approach to that. Last year, Washington Middle School trained all of the students in the middle school. They wanted to take it really deep and really wide, so they trained all of their students with the understanding that all students have the ability to be leaders, and we haven't maybe tapped into that with all students yet, so we wanted to prepare all students and help them to really understand. Jefferson Middle School this year has begun a process of making sure all students are trained. They trained all of their 7th graders, and each year we'll train all of their 7th graders so that at one point throughout their time at the middle school, they will be able, all students will have the training. So we do the student leadership training in a couple different ways at some of our schools, but also other than the 6-hour student leadership training at the middle school level, there's a classroom component, which is a shorter lesson that the guidance counselors do when they have time with all of the grade levels, all of the students. So it's a brief overview of Green Dot so all students know the language, know what is expected of them of helping to stop violence in their school. At the high school level, the rest of the student body engagement is a little bit different. We might do a poster campaign. We might do an assembly so that all students start understanding the language and know that there are options for them if they see a potentially high-risk situation happening.
I'm talking with Mae Hinchin. She's Learning Support and Equity Liaison with Dubuque Community Schools. We're talking about their Green Dot anti-bullying program. Also with me is Jake Troja, Director of School Climate Transformation with Des Moines Public Schools. And Jake, as we were talking about earlier, you have a lot of different approaches at the different schools in your community. One thing that I know is really important to you and really district-wide is in Des Moines is to have a firm basis, a firm understanding that there are not good kids and there are not bad kids. And why do you think that's so important to understand when you're taking a look at dealing with bullying behavior?
That's a great question. I think if we back up just a little bit to define bullying, you know, we can look at the way Iowa Code has done that. I just want to note a couple specific facts. One, there's not a federal law specifically talking about bullying. So that's important to note that Iowa has their interpretation of what bullying is. And the way the code reads, you know, we're legally obligated to report out information based on that code. And so I think the word bullying, if we can define it specifically with the way Iowa Code tells schools what to do, helps just kind of clarify the issue, because bullying, that term in general, outside of the school walls or even within the school walls, is a very heavy weighted term. And it almost, when we speak with parents and stakeholders within the community, it seems as if we say and use the word bullying, there's this whole bucket of consequences that come out and allow us to discipline students because of that term. And I just want to be very clear that that's not the case. At the end of the day, we have an obligation to educate students in Des Moines Public Schools, whether they've presented bullying behavior or not. We have the liability and the obligation to educate them. So I think too often we'll see negative behavior from a student and we'll say that's a bad kid. And I use the correlation or the connection of we wouldn't do that with math or we wouldn't do that with reading. Like if a student couldn't read very well, we would never say that's a bad student. We would increase our instruction. We would differentiate our instruction. We provide more support, more specific individualized help to help that student read. And the same thing needs to hold true for behavior. Bullying is a behavior, and as described by the Green Dot program, it's a social context behavior. It lives usually within that social context and for the most part has a function around attention. And so if we know that, we should be able to instruct and teach to that behavior. And so therefore we can really improve students' behavior providing instruction just like we would in other academic areas.
A lot of kids see things in terms of black and white, especially elementary students. That's an age where we really like to quantify and put things in categories. Is there an effort to help kids understand that because somebody may make a bad choice, that doesn't make them a bad person?
Yeah, absolutely. So we, like I mentioned before, we have a framework that kind of says this is our basis around how we're going to address student behavior across the district. And within that framework, we do have social skills that we teach our students specifically around problem solving, conflict, all those type of things that were mentioned prior. And yes, one of the things that we do teach students is how to solve those interpersonal conflicts. At the same time, when do you ask for help? When do you ask for support from an adult? When do you involve a parent in that situation? So we try to come at it in a holistic approach that we're not just talking about bullying behavior, but negative behavior in general, conflict in general, and helping students sort those things out. At the same time, you know, having adults ensure that we're leading and teaching to improve student behavior.
We are talking about efforts to combat bullying both in the Dubuque Public Schools and the Des Moines Public Schools this hour. We'd love for you to join our conversation if you have experiences with anti-bullying programs in your schools or questions for educators. You can give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And May, I can imagine some concern, some trepidation among teachers when thinking about training students to, obviously it's not policing bullying behavior, but I can see maybe a concern that it would turn into that. Is that something that teachers kind of pushed back on when Green Dot was first implemented?
One of the messages that we give to everyone when we're having a conversation about Green Dot is that, first of all, we don't fight violence with violence. So if we're in our student leadership training and a student brainstorms that what they could do is go up and push the bully, then we always make sure we say, no, we don't fight violence with violence. And the other message that we really give to all of the participants is don't ever put yourself in a situation where you could be harmed. Your safety is first. And so we do prepare children. Like, there are times when something may seem larger than what you can handle. So if you see something maybe online that's really getting out of hand, and then maybe a person who has been a target of some sort of negative behavior begins to make a threat towards himself or others, you know, those are the types of situations that we advise children. There are times, because remember, if we're talking to middle school students, you are 12, and there might be something that you feel like you're in over your head. And that's one of the things that we really like about the Green Dot program is we empower students with so many different skills that they can use. And just because, for example, I'm a person who might feel comfortable directly getting involved, doing it myself, I don't always have to directly get involved and do it myself. I can pick other ideas of Green Dots to do depending on the situation. If I'm alone, I might not feel comfortable doing it myself because what if the person who's engaging in the high-risk behavior turns on me? So if I'm alone, maybe the better thing for me to do is to get others to help. So it's not just a one and done for each person. One of the things that we teach children is sometimes it's hard to get involved. Sometimes we're maybe afraid of the person. Maybe the person is older than us. Maybe the person is more popular than us. Maybe the person's bigger than us. I mean, it can be a size issue. And so sometimes it is hard to get involved. And that's why we give them so many different options. So we really haven't had pushback from teachers, to answer your question, about that, because teachers know that students influence each other more than anything else, that students are looking at each other for acceptance and that feeling of inclusion. And so teachers know that students have the power. But we also, of course, that doesn't mean that adults in the school can let up on our supervision and our intervention if we see negative behaviors happening, because it really is all of our responsibility.
Now, just in the last couple of weeks, of course, a lot of people have been very, very concerned about major violence taking place in specifically in high schools, but any schools after the Parkland shooting. And Dubuque Public Schools were closed last week because of a threat. May, how does Green Dot deal with a situation like that?
Well, very, very specifically to that situation in our decision to close our schools last Friday because of a perceived threat. The reason that we became aware of that was because other children came forward and reported. So that I think that's a really good example of kids doing the right thing. We have so many children in our school district who are not only concerned for their own safety, but the safety of everyone in their schools. And so when they heard a potentially high-risk situation, then they came forward and they used the delegate that others can help, and they reported it to adults. So we were really appreciative of the kids who knew it was something that was bigger than, you know, picking on somebody at lunch. It was bigger than that, and they needed to let adults know. So we framed that through our Green Dot lens in our district and how well the students took on the responsibility that we all can do something to prevent violence in our schools.
Let's go to the phones. Bruce is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Bruce.
Oh, hi there. Yes, I'm a graduate of a junior high in Des Moines, Warren Harding. And I've heard that school is just really having serious problems with discipline there. The bullying is quite overwhelming within the school, and also that the teachers are feeling very vulnerable to the kind of aggressive behavior of students. So when I hear people talking about these good programs where kids help each other, that's great. But I'm wondering what happens when a school seems to be looking like it's kind of on the edge of not being able to control the students, and teachers feel vulnerable, and then where the teachers feel vulnerable involves their intervening in what are repeated outbreaks of bullying of a very physical sort among the students. So
all right.
I would just like to hear a comment on that. Thank you.
Yeah, Bruce, thanks so much for asking that question. Jake, I'm going to let you tackle that one. When bullying becomes overwhelming to the teaching staff.
Right. I think that's a very difficult situation to be in from any perspective, whether you're the teacher or the student or the administrator. I don't want to dismiss any of the challenges that are coming to the table. He mentioned Harding Middle School, but other, you know, we have 10 middle schools in Des Moines Public Schools. Roughly 9,000 students attend middle schools, you know, on a daily basis. And the challenges that, you know, come to the table every day are high. So in that situation, you really have a culture issue more than you really have an individual student problem. What I don't want to separate out is that, yes, students are coming to the table with challenges, but we don't, again, I want to go back to that, we don't have bad students coming to the table. What we have is we're having some instruction that's not meeting the need of our students. Specifically, you know, if we look at any of our middle schools where that might be the case that was described by the listener, is, you know, we have an instructional issue, we have a culture issue, we have several issues that need to be addressed. And I think bullying behavior comes out of that negative environment. So when it's allowed to occur within that social context, then it does. And so it's a very tumultuous situation to be in when the culture of the building is not in a place that's positive. So I don't know if I answered that question specifically. If the listener could maybe rephrase it or clarify my statement, that'd be helpful.
Well, we are nearly out of time. Okay. So I want to take just a moment to look to the future. Jake, How often are you revisiting what you're doing in the Des Moines Public Schools and looking at implementing changes and looking to the future? Because obviously the way bullying is taking place, that seems to be changing pretty dramatically in our culture today.
Absolutely. All the time, to answer your question, you know, we know that I think the listener used the word control. Control is not alone is not going to get us an outcome that we want. So one of the things that we're doing right now is reassessing the way that we provide support to schools, reassessing the way that we've structured up our plan to really make sure that we help schools address the whole child need. It's that's an area that we're building into is, are we not only providing safety and security, but what about physiological needs? Are those being met? And what about the social emotional needs? And are those being met so that when students enter into our school and are at our school, that we have a whole child that's ready to learn. So one of the things that we are moving towards is how we can help produce that positive whole child effect to have a student that's ready to learn. So all the time, we're always evaluating the data. We're always evaluating our outcomes and seeing how we can improve.
Jake Troja, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Jake Troja, Director of School Climate Transformation with Des Moines Public Schools. And May Hinchin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charity.
May Hinchin is the Learning Support and Equity Liaison with Dubuque Community Schools, and we were talking about different anti-bullying policies at those two school districts, including the Green Dot program that's been implemented in Dubuque. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The new mini documentary, How to Run 100 Miles, a film about persistence from SemiRad, follows friends Jason and Brendan as they prepare for and take on a 100-mile run. Brendan is the narrator of the film, and here's a moment that includes his description of his friend Jason and the challenge they're about to take on.
The only reason I got into ultra running at all is because Jason's a great storyteller.
He's now swinging a hammer at all of us, right? Where did the big gulp go on a motorcycle?
You'll never believe who punched me in the face 3 times at Hungry Bear. He's like, what are you talking about? It's like Drew's mom.
One day in August 2015, I took him out for pizza while he told me about how horrible his long trail run had gone that day.
Have my shirt off, I'm bored in sweat, no water. I'm like, man, what am I gonna do?
It sounded like just what I needed. I don't even like running, but I like challenges, especially when they're big and scary enough to get me off the couch. We signed up for a couple of shorter races. If you look it up, you'll find that an ultramarathon is any race longer than a marathon, which is 26.2 miles. They usually start at the 50K distance, which is 31 miles, and then the 50-mile distance, and then 100K, which is 62 miles, and then the races that are 100 miles or longer. We tried the shorter distances, got our asses kicked in every way you can imagine, and barely finished before the cutoffs. If we tried a 100-mile ultramarathon, we'd be extreme underdogs.
All right, that's just a moment from the film How to Run 100 Miles, a film about persistence put out by REI. And the Jason in the film is Jason Syme. He lives in Colorado now, but he grew up in Iowa, in Sioux City, Maquoketa, and Burlington. He went to college at the University of Northern Iowa. And running 100 miles is not the hardest thing he's ever done. He is here with me now. Hello, Jason.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on today's show.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And we get to learn a little bit more about you in the film, not just about this quest to run 100 miles, although we'll talk about that in just a few minutes, but also some of the real challenges that you faced as a kid growing up in Iowa. Your mom was a single mom and you were one of 6 kids. Tell me a little bit about life when you were growing up.
Yeah, as a film illustrates, growing up as a child, I always describe, even back then when I look at some of the documents that were I'd write as a kid, as my childhood as being chaotic and chaos. And that was partly due because my parents getting divorced at a very early age for me when I was in third grade. And then the other part of that was getting bullied myself at an early age. And then we spent a period of our time being homeless and living in an abandoned women's shelter. And so all of those things added for a very chaotic childhood. And then, you know, my mom doing her best to provide for 6 kids, that made it very difficult at times. So we grew up pretty poor, sort of all survival mode in terms of each one of us kids having to defend for ourselves and trying to do what we can to survive to make it through the day.
And in addition to all of those challenges, you were also diagnosed with dyslexia as a kid, right?
Yes, and that's where dyslexia, and that's where some of the bullying took place, because I was also trying to figure out, okay, I feel that I'm different. I feel like the learning's harder for me than some of my classmates are going through. And so people, you know, when you go into a resource room and the school, the public schools did a great job in trying to provide me with the tools that I needed. It was just that when you go into a resource room back then, you sort of had a label on your back, and so I got picked on a very early age. And you try to run away from the label of being dyslexic or slow or stupid.
And one of your responses to being picked on back then was to get into fights. Tell me about that.
Yeah, and I think that part of the fighting came from, you know, the morning in my childhood when I would, before I even go to school, my routine in the morning and just growing up the way it was so stressful at different times that you'd enter the school itself and the last thing you wanted to do was worry about a bully picking on you, and so you'd sort of be like a volcano getting ready to burst just by the time you got to school. And I think the one time that I shared the story in the film was about a time that I was exactly that. I was getting ready to burst, and I had enough of this bully picking on me, and I had enough, and he book dropped me, which is a classic way of slamming some kid's books to the ground, and I ended up fighting back for once. And looking back, I don't obviously condone fighting, but it was a time for me to stick up for myself when there wasn't adults around me to protect me, and that needed to happen, and it altered my course in terms of how I was seen and presented myself.
Now, everything you're describing, I mean, you were a kid at risk. It would have been really easy for things to go really wrong. You discovered wrestling at some point, and that became a real area of focus for you. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I discovered wrestling because I was so short in basketball that no one even gave me the basketball. So when I tried out for basketball, people, I was like, how do you even play this sport? Because I'm not getting the ball at all. I'm never playing. I'm never participating. So I was like, well, this isn't a sport for me. And so I had a couple friends early on in middle school. They're like, you should try this wrestling thing. And so I tried wrestling thing. And what I liked about it early on, even though I didn't win a single match in the beginning, was the fact that it was one-on-one. It didn't require you, any of the teammates you were sort of, you know, as you go out as an individual to see what you could do to win a match. And I really respected that aspect of wrestling, and it taught me some values of, you know, hard work, discipline, and what you can do for yourself to win a match. There is definitely a team element in wrestling, but a lot of it's on the individual, what you do on the mat. And so that sort of taught me the lesson of, okay, you can make progress. It may be hard, it may be difficult, but if you stick with something long enough, you can actually get the results that you're after, and that was winning my first match. And that was a huge momentum change in my thinking, too, of like, oh, look at this. I stuck with it. I didn't give up, and now I'm winning matches. And then my freshman year, I'm in varsity.
Wow. And you stuck with it for a long time before winning a single match.
Yeah, 2 years. 2 years of not
winning
a match.
Wow, 2 years. You were really determined.
Determined or not too smart?
Let's go with determined, all right? And so in spite of meeting with success on the wrestling mat, I mean, you were still struggling with school. You wanted to go to college, and you asked your guidance counselor, okay, you know, what do I need to do to get into college? And basically he said, that's not for you.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the film can't go into a lot of stuff, but I barely graduated from high school with exactly 48 credits. I was, you know, the last, my senior year, while most of my friends were taking off half days because they didn't need many classes, I was taking 7 to 8 classes just so I could actually graduate. So I knew that a path for me at the time was to be able to pursue higher education so I could get out of poverty, and college seemed like the best path for me, and so I wanted some help. I didn't have any idea. My mom was too busy with, maintaining a full-time job, trying to raise the other 5 kids, and so I was looking for guidance on how I approach this. What tests do I take? What do I prepare? And when I went in, the conversation was like, college is not for people like you, Jason. And that's, I was like, you have to be kidding me. I mean, I said different words in my head at the time,
right.
But, you know, it was also a chance for me to go, okay, there's another person telling me that I can't do something. I'm going to go out and do it.
So you did, you started out at community college. You went to UNI. When you were in school, you discovered politics. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I went to the University of Northern Iowa, actually, because teachers I had some great teachers that actually believed in my skills and my ability. And I was like, wow, if those teachers can have that much of a powerful effect on me, I want to go to school to be a teacher, to actually inspire kids like they inspired me. So I went to the University of Northern Iowa. Of course, then life takes place, and after the 2000 election, Gore happened to lose the election, and I was complaining to my college professor at the time and saying, how can they do this, the Supreme Court? How can they change the election this way? I couldn't believe it. I was so worked up and frustrated. And the college professor at the time looked at me, and he paused, and he was like, well, what did you do to help Gore get elected? I said, I voted for him. He's like, no, I asked you, what did you do to help Gore get elected? And I was like, well, what could I do? He's like, you could have volunteered. You could have knocked door. And I had no idea that there was that level of involvement in terms of ways to participate in politics. So I was like, I had no, you know, I said, well, how can I get involved? And then he handed me a flyer at the time for the Iowa Democratic Party, who was looking for canvassers, and I applied to be a canvasser in the summer of 2001.
So you ended up working on Leonard Boswell's campaign, but during this period, you found a lot of direction in politics, but physically, you really lost your way. You had kind of a crisis moment physically in your 20s. Tell me what you experienced.
Yeah, I would say, I like to say people when I'm talking about this is that, you know, I spent 16 years working in politics. The first 8 years I consider my blackout years, where I abused antidepressants. I gained roughly 75 pounds. I smoke a lot, and I would start drinking scotch at my desk about 5 o'clock. And part of that was because I had no tools of how to take care of myself when working in a stressful environment. I thought that I could manage all the stress and pressures through drugs. And my health really started to deteriorate at a rapid rate. I remember thinking in my early 20s, going, wow, I can't believe how bad my health is. And this is a career I'm choosing to do the rest of my life, and having some real problems with thinking, I don't know if I'm going to make it, if this is already how my body and how I'm feeling already. And then I sort of found a turning point when I went to Las Vegas, of all places, where I thought I was really going to, you know, be the character of Leaving Las Vegas, Nicolas Cage, where he drinks himself to death. I thought that was actually going to be me, and instead I happened to find yoga. And that was a real big turning point, because what it did is allow me to find something to relieve and manage the stress and pressures through another outlet, and that outlet was a healthy option. And that healthy option then led me to discover a bunch of other healthy options.
And one of those is running, but not just running, running really, really, really far. So why not just be in shape, go for some jogs? What is the appeal of ultra marathoning to you?
Well, I mean, I think that the appeal to ultra marathoning comes from, you know, I'm fortunate that I've spent the last, since 2008, living in Colorado. So I had some time to be on the Colorado trails and really enjoy trail running. And then when it comes to ultra marathon, you know, I love a challenge, and part of my narrative always been, okay, has all the things that has happened to me growing up and the experiences I've been through, does that equal that I can, you know, go through or do really tough things? And anytime I would read a book or I'd see a movie or I hear someone talk about ultra marathon, I would always think in my head, huh, that seems really tough and really difficult and really horrible. I wonder if I could do that. And so part of it was like a fascination, the question going, okay, can I push myself and push my limits? And that sort of led into me signing up for my first ultra marathon. And the other thing I would say is the first one I signed up for was roughly a decade after I had ran my first marathon. So I ran my first marathon in 2005, but I was almost 75 pounds heavier than I am today, and I barely made it across the finish line. And so the first time I signed up, I was like, okay, I want to do something tougher, longer, to sort of show how far I've came in 10 years. And so that's why I signed up for that originally, the first 50-miler.
How did that first 50-miler go?
It was everything that I imagined it being, very difficult, very hard. I barely crossed the finish line. I had my left knee started really hurting really bad, and so it was roughly like 13 hours and 30-some minutes. It was a real, real, real difficult race. But something about it, again, proving that you could do something with some training, sticking with it and not giving up, and then having that success, I was like, okay, I can stick with this. I did this. I didn't think it was possible. I had originally signed up for a shorter race and then decided to do the 50-miler. So it was just another notch, I would say, in the belt going, okay, here's another example that the wrestling taught me a long time ago that I'm continuing to prove.
Well, and I encourage everybody to watch this short documentary. It's only about 25 minutes, and it's inspiring and enjoyable and funny and lovely at the same time, following you and your friend Brendan as you prepare for a 100-mile run, the Run Rabbit Run 100-mile race in Colorado, which is not just 100 miles, but 100 really tough miles. I'm curious, though. I mean, anybody can see you go through this process in the film, and during that race where you just were not going to give up in spite of many signs telling you that that would probably be the best choice at any given moment. But after the race, the part in the documentary we don't get to see, tell me how you feel after you finish a challenge like that.
I mean, directly, the film sort of illustrates with me crying. Now, people think it's an emotional crying that you're finishing, and that is part of it. And also, it is very emotional to see all the people supporting you, and that's why I'm crying. And then the other big portion was I was in such incredibly pain. I mean, it shows me running, but to even take a step, I thought literally I was going to pass out from pain. So there was part of that. So once that sort of was done, finished, the feeling is, it's hard to describe. It's like a feat of a lifetime that you've just done, and it's almost like you're like observing someone else and not yourself. When people coming up and congratulating, yeah, you ran out of miles, you're like, are you talking about me? You don't really believe that it's you. The 2 weeks after, though, and my girlfriend would attest this, about a week after the race, I was in a lot of pain. I had to ice my foot. I had to rest it. She took care of me and did a lot for me that I couldn't do on myself because I was pretty hobbled up. And that the film does not show that portion, but I was bedridden for 4 or 5 days. I didn't put on shoes for about a week because my feet were so swollen. So there is a portion of there was some real suffering afterwards.
But how does it change you? I mean, you've overcome so much in your life and you inspire a lot of other people, but how do you think it changes you as a person to have accomplished that race in particular?
I think that it builds, if it's possible, it adds additional confidence to my ability to achieve anything in life. And I know that the film sort of illustrates that, but it still makes it even more crisp. Another notch, like I said before, another notch in the belt that, yes, I can do this. It also, in terms of other goals or other things, it gives another plan and approach to wanting to accomplish something else and realizing, okay, these are the lessons that this thing taught me. Again, it's patience. Again, it's commitment. And it's, again, like I've said before, big goals, they're not going to just lay down for you. They're going to be challenging, and there are going to be things that come up that you're going to have to go through. But you have to be committed to finishing it and seeing it all the way through. And once you commit, then resources and other tools make themselves available. That's why when I turned around walking down the hill backwards, that was part of that.
Does it make you feel like you could do anything?
Anything. There's a few things that I'm like, I don't know. You know, dunk a basketball. I'm 5'6". That may be challenging, but I'd give it my best shot.
Well, Jason, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Jason Syme, he lives in Colorado, but he grew up in Iowa, and he's the focus of the new short film put out by REI and Semirad. It's called How to Run 100 Miles, a film about persistence. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.